Friends, we have come to the final session of the forum for this lectureship. It's been a real joy to me to be here, as it always is. Freed Hardeman College has a very warm place in my life. I've been coming to these lectureships since back in the late 30s, and I have been participating in them since the 40s. I do not know exactly how many times I've conducted the forum, but a good many times. And I always enjoy the hearty participation characteristic of the audience, which adds materially to the interest of it. I appreciate the great work that this school has done through the years. I rejoice in its potential. It is my confirmed conviction, however, that it's vital for it to adhere to the traditions and to the principles that have characterized it in times past, that its usefulness to the cause of Christ will depend upon maintaining these same standards. And I sincerely hope that these lectures have made some contribution to that end. I appreciate the conduct of the services by Brother Wright. Brother Wright is a longtime friend of mine, and he's done well in it. It's been a joy to me to have the privilege of sharing the hospitality of the home of Brother and Sister Bradfield. I know no finer Christian people. I've been staying in their home for many, many years in coming to these lectures. The lecture week is the hardest week of the year for me. I conduct nearly 40 meetings a year, but in no other week is there so much physical drain on me as in this particular week. Nonetheless, I enjoy it greatly and appreciate the opportunity particularly. Now, again, I apologize to the many of you who've asked questions that we simply cannot deal with. We had so many, but nonetheless, we were glad to have everyone because it enabled us, in view of the fact that there were so many, to be selective and so present what we believe would be of most interest. I have avoided as much as I could some of the questions that have been up in other years. There are some questions that are perennial. Every year I get questions on exactly the same passages about the same matters, and we've answered them again and again and again. Well, it's not objectionable to have them, but in view of the fact that there were other matters that came up this time, I thought it well for us to deal with them. Brother Woods, would there be any circumstance where the church could be scripturally referred to as the Christian church? For example, where a conservative Christian church does not use an instrument in worship. To speak where the Bible speaks and to be silent where the Bible is silent, and to call Bible things by Bible names, necessitates the use of such terms as are therein. Inasmuch as the church is not called the Christian church, I would then object to such usage. Now, it is a Christian church in the sense that it's composed of Christians. But if we're going to use biblical phraseology, then we ought to use it as it's used in the New Testament. The Lord said, Matthew 16:18, upon this rock I will build my church. It's then Christ's church. Or as Paul puts it in Romans 16:16, the churches of Christ salute you. For that reason, I think it better to stay with the phraseology that appears in the New Testament. Another question here, bordering on that. A Christian church has no baptistry. Would it be right to allow a Christian church preacher to use our baptistry to baptize a person for remission of his sins and know that the one baptized would then worship in error, using the instrument and in other error? I would oppose such. I would not be a party to encouraging someone to do something that involved continuing in error. John said, if anyone come to you bringing not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. For he that biddeth him Godspeed is a partaker with him in his evil deeds. Now, someone will remind us that that has reference to denying the deity of Christ. Well, be it so. But the principle involved, I think, extends to the propagation of any error. If it's limited to that, then on what grounds could we draw the line anywhere? And so I would not be a party to the encouragement of the proclamation of error. Error that in itself is fatal in nature. Now, sometimes brethren hold to errors that are simply errors of interpretation, errors that do not involve things that would affect necessarily the salvation of the soul. There are some things that you can believe and be wrong and still go to heaven. There are other things that if you believe, you can't go to heaven. Well, I'd make a difference between the two. Matters involving fellowship. Now, surely I'll get a rise out of somebody on that, all right.
Brother Wood, in my preaching, I've had quite a bit of contact with people in the Christian church. And I've found out that a good many people who are members of the Christian church have been baptized into the Christian church. And that's about the size of the immersion. And sometimes, by the way, it's also true with the independent Christian church. I have a very good friend who's a minister in the Christian church, the independent Christian church. And he and I have conversations a good many times. And he's not really sure whether or not baptism is a condition of salvation. We found that out in our private conversations many times. And we know each other well enough that we can talk pretty clearly to each other. I asked him one day when we were talking what he would do one Sunday morning if he extended the invitation, and the Baptist preacher that he and I were talking about, a personal friend of both of ours, would respond to the invitation and ask for membership in his independent Christian church. And he just never could quite figure out how to answer that, because he wasn't really sure whether the Baptist preacher had been baptized for the remission of sins or not. New Testament for the remission of sins, you understand? Say something about that.
Well, it's my observation that most of the Christian church preachers of today place very little emphasis on the essentiality of baptism. Now, there is a small group of them, the Ottumwa, Iowa group, the Voice of Evangelism group that does. But most of them do not. I was talking to a Christian church preacher some time ago in West Texas about the plan of salvation. I asked him if he thought baptism was necessary to salvation. He said no. I said, well, then how do you deal with such passages as Galatians 3:27? He says, what does Galatians 3:27 say? Now, how could a man with such a background as that teach people what to do to be saved? And therefore, I think that we ought to just insist upon adhering to the truth all of these matters. Anybody further on any of this? All right, sir.
I'll be blackballed that I am a Christian church preacher. And I've been coming here for 2 or 3 years and I enjoy it very much. But I could give evidence more than it comes by. Of course, I don't think that you meant to infer that this was the only group that believed that it was a mission of sin. But I think there are thousands of Christian churches and preachers who do this. Now, since coming here, it seems that a lot of people think that all Christian churches are disciples of Christ in nature. And that's not true alone.
Isn't it true, though, that there are many thousands of Christian church preachers who do not believe in baptism for remission of sins?
In the disciples' church, yes.
Well, they call themselves Christian churches, do they not? Yes. Isn't it a further fact that there are more Christian church preachers who do not today believe in baptism for remission of sins than there are who do?
No, I disagree with you. I mean, we don't have evidence.
Well, just what would be your opinion in the matter?
In what matter?
As to the relative number who do and who do not. In other words, is it not a fact that the disciples' denomination is much, much larger than the independent groups that you perhaps would endorse and support?
I wouldn't say so, no. We have many more missionaries than they do.
And we're not speaking of missionaries, we're talking about preachers.
Mm. But I don't think the record approves that.
Well, then,
the disciples of Christ from Indiana and in Missouri, where I'm from, but I would say other than those two states, that there's not.
Well, we're very happy to have you, sir, and we appreciate you getting up and speaking. All right, sir. May well be, but it is a fact that such schools, for example, as Butler University in Indianapolis, the preachers that they turn out up there have little regard for not only the commands of the Bible, but the inspiration of the Bible. And so I think that we all understand clearly that that is the drift that's characteristic of that. Now, that there are those, as this gentleman here indicates, who believe in the plan of salvation well, and we rejoice in that. We just hope that he'll accept all that the New Testament teaches and so become then a member of the Church of Christ. All right.
I just want to say, and that's the next thing that I'm observing since we've been in the church, running the part of a large group of churches, I'm most committed to talking. And when I went to the church, I went to basically because I've never heard the plan of salvation. The first time I heard it was by a member of the church.
Yes, sir. I believe that to be characteristic of the disciples' denomination. Anything further on that point? Brother Woods, was the word Christian given by inspiration or by derision? It was given by inspiration. I never did see why anybody ever thought that the name Christian would convey the idea of a slander. It was an honored name. The disciples were glad to embrace it, and in the 7 or 9 instances in which the Greek verb occurs, were called, it always has reference to a divine calling. And further evidence of that is to be found in the fact that in James, the 2nd chapter, the 7th verse, we read, "Do not they blaspheme that worthy name by which you are called." Now, to blaspheme is to speak against something that's sacred. You slander man. You blaspheme God or that which is related to God. That evidences the fact, then, that the name itself is sacred in its implications. And so I do not believe that the name Christian was given by derision. It is an honored name. The disciples were called Christians, first in Antioch. If any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. And Paul was trying to make a Christian out of old Agrippa, and he recognized that fact. No, the name was not given in derision. Brother Woods, there is a fast-growing practice, even in the Brotherhood, of electing elders for staggering terms of 2, 3, or 4 years. Please comment on the Bible pattern on the appointment of elders as to the length of time. Well, I certainly know of nothing in the Scriptures that would support this idea of electing elders to begin with. Elders are designated, of course, with the congregation when they are found to have the appointments of the Holy Spirit. And as long as they have those characteristics, it's their obligation to serve. Sometimes people talk about whether or not an elder can resign. Of course he can't. Because the moment that he starts trying to, he's already out. He can just save himself the trouble. If he doesn't want to serve, he doesn't qualify. And if he doesn't qualify, then he's no longer an elder. And so this idea that the eldership involves some sort of an official position to which a person is elected and has to serve out his term, that's ridiculous. It'd be pretty bad if in some instances they had to serve out their terms unless you could designate the place where the term should be served. I knew of an elder that had of a congregation that had an elder in it that said, that wrote a letter, and there's a copy of it available, where he said that the congregation wants brother so-and-so to preach for us, but I won't have him. I won't have no man that parts his hair in the middle. Now that would certainly eliminate Brother Charles Hauser, wouldn't it? Who wants to comment about this election of elders?
We were having quite a problem around our area of Arkansas some time ago with the Andrews. There was a lot of voting carried on, and there was a big problem. And I was wondering over a situation. In 2 Corinthians 8, 19, I believe, the word chosen is somewhat similar to Acts 14, 23. As I understand, for his current deal or something very similar to that. And has that word changed from its actual meaning in the first century? The question of Barry has the term to mean a stretching out by hands or to vote by stretching out by hands.
Well, in that particular instance, of course, there was an indication of acceptance of them, and that same thing is true today. There must be some way by which the congregation expresses its approval or acceptance of the men, and whatever method is used is accomplishing the purpose. And as to how they did it in that day, or as to the exact method of indicating their choice, there's no particular significance in that. The question is of whether or not there was a choice exercised, and indeed there is. Today, usually it's done by canvassing the congregation and by ascertaining the feelings of the mature members of the church as to the identity of the men that they believe possess the scriptural qualifications. They are then placed on a board and left there for a few days or weeks with the instruction that if there are any scriptural objections to be offered, that they be handed in. And then at the end of that period, if none, then that the men are selected. And that, it seems to me, is as good as any way, since there is no definite pattern for such selection. But since they are selected by the congregation, on the basis of their scriptural qualifications, it would follow that when they cease to be scriptural, then the same means by which they were put in would put them out. In fact, as I pointed out a few moments ago, they're already out when they cease to serve. You might call a farmer a farmer. When he quits farming and goes to selling groceries, he's no longer a farmer. And when a man ceases to function as an elder, he's no longer an elder. Now, that doesn't mean that a man is an elder simply because he performs the duties of one, but he has to perform the duties of one before he is one. And therefore, when he ceases to perform the duties, he ceases to be an elder. Anything on that? Somebody relay what he said. I just didn't get enough of it to understand what he said. We don't hear well from that area over there.
If a man was sick and could no longer function actively, would he still be considered an elder?
No, when he became unable to perform the functions of an elder, he wouldn't be any more an elder than there is a preacher who no longer preaches. Suppose the preacher in the congregation ceases to be able to perform the functions of a preacher. Now, it's very true that the other elders might continue to use him as from the standpoint of advice and counsel, but he certainly would not be performing the functions of an elder. And then here's another widespread area along that line. It wasn't my intention to get on this because we often talk about it, but there's another aspect of it. Some folks have the idea that the authority, which the scriptures very definitely set out regarding elders, vests in an elder. There isn't any truth in that. An elder, as such, does not exercise authority. It's the eldership that does. Now, when the eldership has reached a proper decision regarding a matter, then that's authoritative in the field of expediency. But then, just because one man has been selected an elder, and he himself, and certainly not when his wishes are contrary to the wishes of others, expresses them and urges that therefore, because he's an elder, he has authority, that's an absurdity. There is no leadership where there is not unity in the eldership. A man may have differences of opinion, but when they come out of a meeting, they ought to be agreed on the course that they're going to pursue. How else can the congregation follow? And I have come to a new and deeper appreciation of the value of elders, particularly through the difficulties the church passed over the anti-movement. Because so far as my knowledge extends, not one single congregation ever split or had serious difficulty over that matter where the elders stayed together and performed their proper functions. It is always when the elders were divided among themselves. Now, some of them actually encourage difficulty. I know of instances where elders actually decided in business meetings that they wouldn't have anything to do with anybody that had anything to do with either side of it. They were going to be perfectly neutral. But some of them began to shout for help when the antis got in among them and began to throw some of them out. They wanted some of us to come and help them. And so it's only when there is unity in the eldership that there can be authority, exercise, and influence wrought. All right. Who has a further statement? Yes.
Brother Wood, if the six elders elect a man, they want to become the seventh elder, put his name on the board and keep contesting, the congregation does not object, then has the congregation chosen a new elder?
Yes, sir. I think they have. I think that by their very acquiescence in the matter, that they have accepted him. In other words, by their, I think it means more than just saying they have no objections to him, no scriptural objections. I think the very fact that they have not brought forward objections means that they accept him as such. At least that would seem to follow. What would Christ say about women sitting in on the business meetings of the church? Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and ask him, since he never said anything about it while he was here. Maybe he couldn't conceive of such a thing happening, though sometimes they sit in remotely on them. As a matter of fact, I know of a congregation that some years ago had a treasurer who was a woman and who was a member of the Baptist Church. Now, if that strikes you as strange, I might explain that her husband was a professional man, and she was his secretary, and he was the treasurer of the church, but she wrote all the letters and made all the checks and made all the deposits and kept up with all of the records and supplied them to the church. So if that doesn't make a treasurer out of her, I don't know what it would take to do it. Do the scriptures teach degrees of happiness for the faithful in heaven and degrees of misery for the wicked in hell? I believe so. In Daniel 12 and 3, they that turn many to righteousness shall shine as the stars forever and ever. Will those who turn only a few or none at all shine just as brilliantly? We read in Matthew chapter 16:27 that the Lord shall reward every man. Now how? In exactly the same way? According to his works, so the text says. Now, unless every man works exactly the same, if the reward is proportioned to the works, then the extent of the works will determine the extent of the reward, if that means anything. In Luke 12, it is said that he who knows his master's will and does it not shall be beaten with many stripes. He who knows it not but does things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few stripes. Does not the number of stripes in this instance determine the extent of the punishment? If not, why not? Who has a comment? Did everybody accept that? I'd be surprised if they did. We'll be glad to have someone raise a further point on that, if you will. Well, all right then, we got lots of questions here. We'll be going this time next week. Would you explain the phrase "only in the Lord" in 1 Corinthians 7 and 39 in comparison to Ephesians 6 and 1? 1 Corinthians 7:39 forbids a widow to marry except in the Lord. Now in Ephesians 6:1, children obey the parents in the Lord. I see no difficulty there. As a matter of fact, only children whose parents are in the Lord ought to be under obligation to obey them, because in the first place, because only Christian parents would be certain not to command them to do things which they ought not. Now that doesn't mean, of course, that children can disobey in matters that are right whether their parents are Christians or not. But in the Lord would suggest, of course, in the church, in my opinion. And so I think this passage simply forbids a widow to marry out of the church. If it doesn't mean that, it's meaningless to me. Would a person's baptism be valid if confession was not made orally? I think it would, except in those cases where it's impossible to make it. I remember Brother Hardiman telling one time about a meeting he was conducting when a deaf mute came forward, unable, of course, to speak, but wanting baptism. Brother Hardiman sat down by him and turned over to Acts 8 in the King James translation and ran his fingers along the words, "If thou believest with all thine heart, thou mayest." And the deaf mute then took the book, ran his finger along the rest of it that said, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." Does anybody in the audience think the Lord wouldn't accept that? Now, I think in a normal case, it would be required to make the confession. With the confession, Paul said, Romans 10:10, with a mouth confession is made into salvation. And that's the normal circumstance. Who has a comment on that? Yes.
Brother Wood, the comment you made a moment ago about the widows marrying only in the Lord, would this be applied also to single girls who have never been married?
Well, I don't believe that that passage can, because in that instance he's talking about widows. Now that involves, of course, another question. I would certainly advise against it, warn against it, because of the disastrous results that so often follows. But I don't think that's the passage to use in an effort to show that such is wrong. All right, now let's see another one here. Yes.
In regard to the widow, is she in sin if she marries outside the body of Christ?
Well, that involves, of course, is the serious question, and a question that has several facets to it. First, that a person who is not a Christian has a right to live with one who is not a Christian is obvious. We learn that from 1 Corinthians 7. But now, as to whether or not the Lord would tolerate and accept such after penitence and after a plea for forgiveness is another question. I'm not sure that the Lord would, if a person deliberately, knowing that the Scriptures positively forbid, entered into that relationship and then with the expectation of making such an acknowledgement later. It would seem to me that such would border on presumptuous sin. But then, with reference to a person who didn't know or have a clear conception of it, and then later learned of these error or sin and did something about it, well, I'm sure the Lord would be merciful. Now, it just simply says that a widow may marry only in the Lord. To be in the Lord is to be in the body of Christ. But the body of Christ is the church. Now, if it doesn't mean that, what does it mean?